Welcome to Human Nature, Buddha Nature, a Bright Earth podcast with me, Casper Thompson, Reverend Casperlita. Everyone calls me Casper. This is episode one, hopefully, of many. Do subscribe wherever you get your podcast so that you can join me on this new and exciting venture as I share some Buddhism with you, share my curiosity about the world with you. What's it like to be a person in the world today? What is the world like today? And how can Buddhism shed some light on that? That's the kind of thing we might be talking about, and we'll see how it goes. I'm treating it a little bit like an experiment. I love following my curiosity, and I hope you'll join me in following my curiosity in the future. We're going to have some guests on, maybe some voices from inside the Bright Earth community, maybe some other people that I'm interested in hearing from, Buddhist, non-Buddhist experts in their own fields. But today, I've got three things for you. The first is a Dharma talk inspired by my, well, I won't spoil it, or maybe I will, inspired by me overwatering one of the plants in the house here and nearly killing it, and relating that to the climate crisis that is really obvious right here now in the UK. Then we've got what I'm calling a pop culture moment. And then finally, we've got a story from the Jataka Tales. I hope you'll enjoy listening to all three. And I hope you'll come back for episode two. If you want to find more out about Bright Earth Buddhism and what we do in the temple, have a look at the website at www.brighterearth.org. And now, section one, the Dharma talk. When you come in through the back door of our house, where all the coats are and the shoes and the dog leads and the bins, there's a small window, and on that window is quite a large succulent. I don't know exactly what kind of plant it is, something spiky. And the other day, Satya said, oh, I'll check if it needs watering. It often gets missed. And I said, I never miss it. So Satya checks it, and of course, it's overwatered. I hadn't missed it. I'd given it far, far too much water. And you could see some of the, are they called leaves? Were beginning to rot at the bottom. So shame-faced, I put it outside in the sunshine straight away, hoping to dry it out. And then later, Satya realized, or maybe already knew, that this succulent was in a pot inside a pot. So the succulent's inside a plastic flower pot that has holes in, and the plastic flower pot is inside the ceramic pot. I just thought it was planted in the ceramic pot. So she lifted it out, and there must have been 2 inches of water in the bottom of this ceramic pot. I'm glad she lifted it out. So we left the plant in the sun, and I think it's doing fine now. A few weeks ago, I heard a succulent expert saying the way to care for them is to drench and dry them. So make the soil wet, wait till it dries completely, make it wet again. I was obviously using the drown and dry method. Why am I telling this story when the world is dying? Such a banal story. It's not going to earn me loads of money as an after-dinner speaker, an anecdote like that. And something on such a small scale, when there's all this big news around us. The UK, like loads of the UK is in drought right now. There's wildfires here, not too far from where I am. There's huge wildfires in Europe. Crops are struggling. Wheat is half the height it should be in this country. food prices will be much more expensive. Apparently, we're already importing broccoli from Spain here in the UK, and I wonder, well, what are people in Spain eating if we've got all the broccoli? But there's some similarities between these two things, right? Although the scale is vastly different in how I didn't take care of the succulent properly and how we don't take care of the world properly. To take care of a plant, you look at the causes and conditions. You create good causes and conditions for the plant to grow in. The right kind of soil, enough light, enough water, not too much water. And the plant itself knows how to grow. You get all of that right, and the plant does the growing itself. A few years ago, when I was studying wild therapy, I read that one of the Chinese characters for nature means something like self-managing. It's a system that takes care of itself. A plant knows how to grow when the conditions are right. The natural world knows how to look after itself when the conditions are right. And actually, the natural world mostly knows how to look after itself. But the conditions weren't right for the plant because I was pouring in too much water. And the conditions aren't right for the natural world because we're pouring in too much carbon, too much methane, too much plastic into the oceans and so on. So what's the response here? It's to examine the causes and conditions. If the job of taking care of a plant is to look after the causes and conditions, the job when something goes wrong is to examine the causes and conditions of the going wrong. How did I end up pouring so much water into the succulent? A combination of rushing and maybe just not being able to estimate how much water it takes to make the soil damp. And then you can look at, well, why was Casper rushing? What had been in my day previously that had led me into that state where I was just trying to get through everything or tick things off the list or get to the point where everything was done and I could have a rest? We'll come back to that in a moment. And it's the same in the world. What are the causes and conditions that mean we're pouring all of this carbon dioxide into the atmosphere? You can look at the way companies are structured to bring profit to shareholders, to always be growing rather than structured as socially and environmentally conscious entities. You can look at how greed works in the world. You know, when somebody is greedy and doesn't have much power, it just affects themselves and maybe a small number of people around them. When somebody is greedy and has a lot of power, it affects a lot more of the world. If I'm in charge of a company that is worth billions of dollars, the decisions I make affect billions of people, affect the whole planet, inevitably. And I just don't think one person should have that much power. When I think about greed, I also think about hungry ghosts. Hungry ghosts in Buddhist cosmology are spirits, beings who are insatiably hungry, hence the name, but have very small mouths and throats and can never fill themselves. So their greed is never satiated. And greed is a bit like that, right? We never get to the end of it. And I think it's even possible that the more we give in to greed, the more greedy we become, because this thing, this amount of money, this amount of status, this amount of whatever it is, this carbon-heavy lifestyle doesn't satisfy us. So we have to have more and more and more. And the more greed there is, the more ill effects there are for ourselves and others. Reverend Saido, who died a few years ago, a friend of mine, someone I worked with for many years, a Zen Buddhist monk. Before he became a monk, he was a sewage engineer. That sounds like a plausible job title, right? I can't remember exactly what he told me. He worked with water, with cleaning water. And he really thought deeply about environmental problems. You become acutely aware of the issues when you're working in that field. But he came to the understanding that there wasn't much he could do in the outer world to fix these problems. There wasn't really anything he could do from that role. He came to understand or believe there wasn't anything he could do to fix things in the world. But he had this inkling he could begin to address the greed, the ill will, the ignorance in his own heart and mind. And maybe even an inkling that beginning to address greed and ill will and delusion there would support a transformation of those things in the world as well. So he quit being a sewage engineer and became a Zen Buddhist monk and became a very wise man. And I do believe there is some kind of cascade from our hearts and minds into the world. The more greed we have, the more that spills into the world, the more the ill effects of that spill into the world. You know, as a therapist, when I'm looking at the causes of compulsive behavior, say, or discontent, or whatever it is that brings someone into therapy, it's often trauma related. I often work with a lot of trauma. Something that's been unprocessed in the client's life, deeply unpainful. Something deeply painful at a time when they didn't have the capacity to handle those feelings. The feelings get exiled. And the way that we exile them is by distracting ourselves, by sliding into greed or into hate of ourselves or others, or into disassociation, whatever it takes to keep those feelings away. And that's, you know, I really appreciate that work. It's good work to be doing. And I'm sure that in lots of the lives of powerful people, there is unhealed trauma that it wouldn't hurt to heal. In fact, more than wouldn't hurt, like it would benefit the whole world, right? If you're in a position of power, get some therapy. But the Buddhist analysis of greed and ill will and delusion goes one step further. It says it's not just a way of avoiding trauma in the sense of some acute event that happened to us at some point in our lives. It's a way of avoiding the existential feeling of separation that we have from the world, from everything else, this existential loneliness, hollowness, separateness that we experience as human beings. That is the backdrop to much of how we live our lives. So let's come back to me watering the plant. And as a therapist, I might look at why I was rushing and trace it back through the causes and conditions of what I was feeling, what feelings was I avoiding, what had happened to me earlier in the day or the week. And there'd be some benefit in that. Potentially I'd find something that I didn't want to acknowledge, something that I was keeping moving quickly to avoid feeling, that led to me rushing through the day and overwatering the succulent. But the Buddhist analysis suggests the benefit of going deeper and acknowledging this existential feeling of separateness is what drives all of the three poisons: greed, ill will, delusion, rushing, which isn't one of the three poisons, but it does show up in one of the lists, the hindrances, I think. And that the antidote to that is connection. It's connection. It's remembering or relearning or learning that we're not actually separate, that this is just some kind of delusion that we fall into as human beings, but that we are deeply connected to ourselves, to the whole world, to each other. For Pure Land Buddhists, particularly the connection to Amida Buddha, remembering the compassion and wisdom of the Buddha flowing towards us, which I know some people frame as compassion and Buddhism of the present moment flowing towards us. The movement in my body, the movement of my breath, of my cells, of the heart pumping blood around my veins is the same movement of the wind in the trees, of the sap rising in the spring. The rule of three suggests I should think of one more example from the natural world, right? But my mind went blank. We're actually deeply connected. And when we can rest in that, the rushing becomes something slower. We're able to dwell in the present moment. And vice versa, if we consciously slow the rushing and dwell in the present moment, we're more likely to notice connection. The more we feel this sense of connection, the more we're present in the present moment, the more likely we are to take care of the plants, the more likely we are to take care of the planet. It's not so easy with the whole world to figure out what we need to do. Like, practically, we know what we need to do, right? Stop using fossil fuels, and all the alternatives are available. But politically, it's tricky to know how we get there. And yet, when I remember Reverend Saido's wisdom, that we begin in our own hearts, there is something profoundly reassuring about that. You know, when I had that conversation with Saido, I was doing a lot of activism. I was involved with Extinction Rebellion Buddhists. I'd been arrested for meditating on the street and thrown out of a Barclays bank in Glasgow for meditating in the bank. They were known for funding lots of fossil fuel activities. It's really important to keep finding ways of acting skillfully in the world. It's not like, oh, just come on, sit on your meditation cushion, work on your own heart. We need both. We need to examine the causes and conditions at all of these levels in the world, in our immediate environment, in our own hearts. So I'm confident if I keep doing that, the houseplants are more likely to live around me. And I'm confident if we all do that, that will be reflected in the whole world. And now it's time for our pop culture moment. My best friend asked me if I was going to do something zeitgeisty that would be really shareable, and they suggested season 2 of Heated Rivalries coming up, and would I do a Buddhist take on that? That would be really shareable, and maybe my podcast would really do the numbers. Part of me really loved the idea of that, and another part thought it sounded like a lot of work. I thought, oh, I'll compromise. I can do a pop culture moment. And then I realized the culture I'm consuming is from ages ago. I'm watching The West Wing on TV. The first time I've watched The West Wing, a show that finished 20 years ago. I'm also watching Schitt's Creek, a show that finished 6 years ago. And the novel I'm reading is a Tanith Lee novel from 1975. The thing that everyone seems to be talking about online is Christopher Nolan's Odyssey and Emily Watson's review of that in the London Review of Books. And I haven't seen the film and I haven't read Emily Watson's review. But I did see stop motion skeletons from Jason and the Argonauts, Ray Harryhausen's film from 1963, thanks to Animation Obsessive, who shared a clip on Blue Sky and wrote about it in their newsletter. It's a film with real actors in. Jason and the Argonauts are played by humans, and occasionally they encounter these stop motion creatures, including these skeletons. A scene that's 4.5 minutes long, I think maybe even was cut from the UK release because it was thought to be too scary for children. And it's so striking. The skeletons move in this kind of wind up clockwork, jerky motion, but they're bones, right? It looks really spooky. I wouldn't want to be surrounded by life-size jerky skeletons. There's something very creepy about it. And it looks realistic. The scene unfolds pretty slowly compared to modern cinema. The tension builds. There's brief moments of action. It's maybe not realistic, but skeletons rising out of the dirt and fighting you isn't realistic. It didn't take me out of the scene at all. In fact, it brought me into it more deeply because it didn't look like a computer game. It looked like real 3D objects that were being interacted with. Apparently it took 4.5 months to do that one scene, which is about and the scene's about 4.5 minutes long, so that's about a month's worth of work for a minute's work of film. Just Ray Harryhausen on his own. He didn't like working in a team. He described CG effects in one interview. He was pretty graceful about how the industry has changed, and he's pretty graceful about other people's work, even work that, reading between the lines, he doesn't like. But he described CG effects as effects by committee. And you know, maybe there's something to that. When there's 30 of you working on one scene, it's a different kind of creativity, right? I think you can be really creative in a team. Although I think if there were 30 people working on this podcast rather than just me and a microphone, maybe it wouldn't be so good. Who knows, right? It's not an experiment I'm willing to have. I do, like me and the microphone, I love the image of Ray Harryhausen on his own, moving these little models fraction by fraction. He basically projected the film that was recorded outside in the world with the real human actors onto a screen, and then set up a diorama with the models in front of the screen, including things like model walls that perfectly matched the walls they'd filmed for the skeletons to move over. And then filmed this diorama frame by frame, advancing the film outside frame by frame, moving the skeletons frame by frame. Very creative. And very different to the big splashy effects you see in superhero films today, where the last third of it, to me, feels like it's just full of action and like watching somebody else play a computer game. I know real people can't move in the way that those characters move. It's very different. It's very different from watching people do stunts like they used to do back in the 70s, where there's this sense of a real body with heft hitting something else. Harryhausen said the effects must serve the story. And I imagine that many filmmakers think that's what they're doing, but I also know how much the algorithm is king these days, right? What can we clip and share on the algorithm? What is going to make it to the top of people's Netflix's queues? How can we hold their attention? You know, I read an article a while ago about the difference between Bluey, the Australian children's TV programme, and Cocomelon, the YouTube channel. And Bluey is made by one person who tries to write jokes for adults and children, and it produces really good television, right? In my opinion. And Cocomelon is made by a committee, so to speak, and they test the programmes by showing them to a room full of toddlers in a room full of distractions. And when the toddler's attention goes from the screen, they know, oh, we have to do something different in the animation now to get their attention back, and they edit it. It's like the science of grabbing people's attention. And what it leads to is this kind of one note, bam, 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 which sounds completely exhausting and overstimulating to me. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the conclusion of this section is. It's not like this is a story with a moral, right? But there's something I really admire about people who really care about the work that they're doing, who spend 4.5 months on their own on 4.5 minutes of film. You know, there's something really powerful about that image to me. Perhaps it's because I can't imagine spending 4.5 months on something that's only going to be 4.5 minutes long, but I really love the idea of it. And I really loved that clip from Jason and the Argonauts, and maybe a date with the whole film is in my future. But now it's time for a story. The Jataka tales are stories of the Buddha's previous lives, little morality plays, a little bit like Aesop's fable. They begin in the present, the Buddha's chatting to somebody, and then he says, oh, something in a previous life will help explain this. So in this story, the story of the Kimsuka tree, the Buddha is chatting to some disciples, and they've all become enlightened through doing different practices. And somebody says, Nibbana is the same. It's of one nature. But we've all done different things to get enlightened. What's going on there? And the Buddha says, ah, this reminds me of the story of the Kimsuka tree. It's about a king with 4 sons who all want to see a Kimsuka tree. So the charioteer takes them out one by one at different times of year. Let me read to you from Sarah Shaw's translation. He showed them the tree at a time when there were just buds on the trunk. Another he showed when the leaves were fresh. Another at the time when it was flowering, and another at the time when it was bearing fruit. In due course, the 4 brothers were sitting down, and one said, what kind of tree is a Kimsuka? One put forward the observation, it's just like a charred stump. A second said, it's like the banyan tree. A third, it's like a piece of flesh. A fourth, it's like an acacia. As they were not satisfied with one another's explanation, they went to the father. Sire, what kind of tree is a Kimsuka? How have you all explained it? He asked. So they told him the way that each had described it. The king said, you 4 saw the Kimsuka tree. The charioteer showed you the whole of the Kimsuka, but you did not question him in detail and ask, what is it like in this season, or what is it like in that season? So doubts arose in you. So the Buddha wanted his monks to know that just like these princes, they'd come into a state of confusion when they could have come into a state of clarity. Awakening shows up differently for people of different temperaments. But that doesn't have to be something that produces doubt. It can produce curiosity that reveals to us more of what awakening is like, more of what enlightenment is like. Oh, it shows up like this for me, it shows up like that for you. Therefore, it must be both of these things somehow. And the Buddha said to the monks, at that time in the past, I was the king. That was me in a previous life. I was the king. And you monks, you were the princes. In the commentary, Sarah Shaw says, this was designed to mitigate schisms in the Sangha after the Buddha died. He was saying, all of these different ways are valid. All of these awakenings are views of something that is bigger than each of the views, but there's something in all of them. I often think of, like, I can see my garden out of lots of different windows in the house, but the view of the garden is a bit different from outside each window. But the garden is still a garden, right? I really like the story of the Kimsuka tree. It speaks to something of the culture of bright earth Buddhism as well, that we understand there are different ways to become enlightened, that in awakening experiences can be different from person to person, and that there is, as it says in another sutra, it all has one taste, the Dharma all has one taste. Towards the end of last year, Satra and I, and the ministry team, but particularly with help from Ananda, Reverend Ananda, we wrote a text called The Statement of Faith, which does what it says on the tin. It describes the sort of doctrine and philosophy and the container, the context for Bright Earth Buddhism. It's the statement of faith. There's two lines I want to read which make me think of this story about the Kimsuka tree. Our heart practice is the Nembutsu, the recitation of Amida Buddha's name. And then the second line I want to read. We treasure Shakyamuni Buddha, who set the wheel of Dharma turning. We learn from Buddhist teachers throughout the ages, awakened beings everywhere, and the world itself. We especially revere the great Pure Land sages, Honen and Shinran. So we have this anchor in one thing. Like the Buddha knew that his disciples had different temperaments, so different things suited them. And to form a community, there has to be some kind of shared temperament, I think. Not that everybody is exactly the same. So we have some shared affinity for Nembutsu in our community, for Pure Land Buddhism, and we are open to receiving wisdom from wherever it appears. And that's the podcast. Thanks for listening. Appreciate your attention. Now, hopefully you'll join us next time on Human Nature, Buddha Nature.